Blog Talk Radio.
And do nothing.
There comes a time when we heed a certain call, when the world must come together as one. There are people dying, oh, when it's time to lend a hand to fight the greatest gift of all. We can't go on pretending day by day that the world somewhere will soon make a change. We all are part of life's great big family, and the truth, you know, love is all we need.
Yeah.
passing the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, on down through the various states, and it would take me successfully home. And I thought about the fact that we hear a great deal about the pilot, the engineer, the co-pilot. But we must never forget that that plane couldn't make its journey without the ground crew. The same thing applies in this area of freedom. As we take out on this mighty flight of freedom, let us never forget the ground crew. Ground crew, the people who don't make the headlines. People who make it possible for the pilot to do his job. Let us never forget the ground. I bring you greetings from the humble people, the ground truth of Montgomery, Alabama. But I'm not here this evening to talk about Montgomery. You've heard a lot about Montgomery, and I've spoken a great deal across the country on the Montgomery story and other ministers in Montgomery and other citizens of that city. So I'm not going to burden you with the Montgomery story. This evening I want to try to answer the question, a desperate question, a poignant question, that seems to be on the lips of people all over this nation. They are disturbed and they are wondering whether there has been any real progress in the area of race relations. Now, if I can give some insights on that question. I certainly can't answer the whole question. I can only make a few suggestions here and there. And Corns, you will have to draw your conclusion. It seems to me that there are three basic attitudes that one can take towards the question of progress in the area of race relations. The first is that of extreme optimism. You know, optimism is a view that looks on the bright side of things. The extreme optimist would argue that we have come a long, long way in the area of race relations. He would point proudly to the strides that have been made in the area of civil rights over the past few decades. And this, he would conclude that the problem is just about solved now, and that we can sit down comfortably by the wayside and wait on the coming of the inevitable. The second view that can be taken is that of extreme pessimism. And you know, pessimism is a view that looks on the dark side of things. So the pessimist in the area of race relations would say that we've made only minor strides. He would argue that the deep rumblings of discontent from the South, indicative of the fact that we have created many more problems than we have solved. He would say that we are going backwards instead of forward. He might even get a little intellectual and think to show that hovering over every man is a tragic taint of original sin, and so at bottom, human nature cannot be changed. He may even turn to the realms of psychology and seek to show the and flexibility of certain attitudes once they had been molded. All of this, the pessimist would conclude that there can be no progress in the area of race relations. Now I want you to notice one thing here, that the extreme optimist and the extreme pessimist agree on at least one point. They both agree that we must sit down and do nothing in the area of race relations. The extreme optimist says do nothing because integration is inevitable. The extreme pessimist says do nothing because integration is impossible. But that is a third position, that is a third attitude that one can take in this area, namely the realistic position. The realist in the area, race relations, seeks to combine the truths of two opposites while avoiding the extremes of both. So the realist would agree with the optimist that we have come a long, long way. He would go on to balance that by agreeing with the pessimist that we have a long, long way to go. And it is this realistic position that I would like to use as a basis of our thinking together this evening on the question of progress in race relations. We've come a long, long way. We have a long, long way to go. Let us notice first that we've come a long, long way, and I would like to say first under that particular heading that the Negro himself has come a long, long way in reevaluating his own intrinsic worth. In order to illustrate this, a little history is necessary. You will remember that it was in the year 1619 that the first slaves landed on the shores of this nation. They were brought here from the shores of Africa. Unlike the Pilgrims who landed at Plymouth a year later, they were brought here against their will. Throughout slavery, the Negro was treated in a very inhuman fashion. He was a thing to be used, not a person to be respected. Was thus something of a depersonalized cog in a vast plantation machine. The famous Dred Scott decision of 1857 well illustrates the status of the Negro during slavery, where in this decision the Supreme Court of the nation said the Negro is not a citizen of this nation. He is merely property, subject to the dictates of his own. This was the attitude that prevailed. Living under these conditions, many Negroes lost faith in themselves. Many came to feel that perhaps they were inferior. So long as the Negro accepted his place assigned to him, sort of racial peace was maintained. But it was a negative peace. It was not true peace. As I've said on so many occasions, true peace is not merely the absence of some negative force, it is the presence of some positive force. One of the white citizens of our community in Montgomery was talking with me the other day, and he said, Brother King, The only thing that hurts me and that concerns me is the fact that for so many years we had such peaceful race relations in Montgomery. We had so much harmony and peace in race relations, and now you people have come to upset me. I thought about it, and I tried to talk with him sympathetically, calmly. I looked at him and said, well, I guess you're right. We did have peaceful race relations in Montgomery. But it was a negative peace, which the Negro patiently accepted injustice and exploitation and never protested again. But we never had real peace in Montgomery. We never had a positive. We had a negative peace which was merely the absence of friction. But true peace is the presence of justice and brotherhood. One day, Jesus stood before a group of men of his generation. I can imagine that they stood before the master with that glittering eyes, wanting to hear something good. And Jesus looked at them and said in no uncertain terms, I come not to bring peace but a sword. Jesus didn't mean he came to bring a physical sword. Neither did he mean he did not come to bring true peace. But what Jesus was saying was this, that I come not to bring this old negative peace, which makes for deadening passivity and stagnant complacency. I come to bring positive peace. And wherever I come, a conflict is precipitated between the old and the new. Wherever I come, a division sets in between justice and injustice. Wherever I come, something happens between the forces of light and the forces of darkness. I come not to bring this old negative peace, which is merely the absence of tension, but I come to bring a positive peace, which is the presence of love and brotherhood and the kingdom of God. The peace which Jesus talks about is always a positive. The peace which existed at this particular time in our nation was a negative peace devoid of any positive meaning. Then as the years unfold, something happened to the Negro. Circumstances made it necessary for him to travel more. His rural plantation background gradually gave way to urban industrial life. His cultural life is gradually rising to the steady decline of crippling illiteracy, and even his economic life is rising to the growth of industry and the power of organized labor and other agencies. All of these forces conjoin to cause the Negro to take a new look at himself. Negro masses all over began to reevaluate themselves. And the Negro came to feel that he was somebody. His religion revealed to him that God loves all of his children and that all men are made in his image. He came to see that every man, from a base black to a treble white, is significant on God's keyboard. And so he could now unconsciously cry out with eloquent voice, greasy locks and black complexion cannot forfeit nature's claim. Sin may differ, but affection dwells in black and white the same. Were I so tall as to reach the pole, or to grasp the ocean at a stand, I must be measured by my soul, the mind is a standard of the man. With this new sense of dignity and this new self-respect, a new Negro came into being. Tensions which we witness in the South today can be explained in part by the revolutionary change in the Negro's evaluation of his nation and destiny, his determination to struggle, suffer, sacrifice, yes, and even die if necessary, until the walls of segregation have been totally crushed. This is the meaning and a part of the meaning of the struggle. We've come a long, long way in 1619. Not only has the Negro come a long, long way in reevaluating his own intrinsic worth, we've come a long, long way in achieving civil rights. And if we are to be true to the facts, we must admit that. 50 years ago, 25 years ago, a year hardly passed that numerous Negroes were not brutally lynched by some vicious mob. Lynchings have about ceased today. We've come a long, long way. 50 years ago, 25 years ago, most of the southern states had a way of preventing the Negro from becoming registered, the registered voter through the poll tax. Now the poll tax has been eliminated in all the 4 states. We've come a long, long way. Even in achieving the ballot, we've come a long, long way. We have a long, long way to go, but we've come a long, long way. Turn of the century, there were not many Negro registered voters in the South. By 1948, that number had leaped to 750,000. By 1952, that number had leaped to 1,300,000. We've come a long, long way. Even in economic development, we've come a long, long way. And so today, the average Negro wage earner makes more, 4 times more than the average Negro wage earner in 1940. The national income of the Negro now is more than $16 billion a year, more than the national income of Canada, and more than all of the exports of the United States. We've come a long, long way. Not only that, in our generation, we have been able to see the world of segregation gradually crumble. Many years ago, we were taken away into an Egypt of segregation, and it looked like we would never get out. We were carried back in 1896. The Supreme Court of this nation, in the Plessy versus Ferguson decision, established the doctrine of separate but equal as the law of the land. And here we were caught up in the Egypt of segregation. Every time we tried to get out, something prevented us. There was always the Moses crying out in loud and noble terms, let our people go.
I wanted to get a big banner printed, and I saw the sign.
Did you? 3 dimensions of a complete life. You know, they used to tell us in Hollywood that in order for a movie to be complete, it had to be 3-dimensional. Well, this morning I want to seek to get over to each of us that if life itself is to be complete, it must be 3-dimensional. Many, many centuries ago, there was a man by the name of John who found himself in prison out on a lonely, obscure island called Patmos. I've been in prison just enough to know that it's a lonely experience. And when you are incarcerated in such a situation, you are deprived of almost every freedom. But the freedom to think, the freedom to pray, the freedom to reflect and to meditate. While John was out on this lonely island in prison, he lifted his vision to high heaven. He saw descending out of heaven, and a new earth. Over in the 21st chapter of the book of Revelation, it opens by saying, "And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, and I, John, saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven." And one of the greatest glories of this new city of God that John saw was its completeness. It was not up on one side and down on the other, but it was complete in all three of its dimensions. And so in the same chapter, as we look down to the 16th verse, John says, "The length and the breadth and the height of it are equal." In other words, this new city of God, this new city of ideal humanity is not an unbalanced entity, but is complete on all sides. I think John is saying something here, and in all of the symbolism of this text and the symbolism of this chapter, he's saying at bottom that life as it should be and life at its best is a life that is complete on all sides. And there are three dimensions of any complete life to which we can fitly give the words of this text: length, breadth, and height. Now, the length of life, as we shall use it here, is the inward concern for one's own welfare. In other words, it is that inward concern that causes one to push forward to achieve his own goals and ambitions. The breath of life, as we shall use it here, is the outward concern for the welfare of others. And the height of life is the upward reach for God. Now, you got to have all three of these to have a complete life. Now let's turn for the moment to the length of life. I said that this is the dimension of life where we are concerned with developing our inner power. In a sense, this is the selfish dimension of life. There is such a thing as rational and healthy self-interest. Great Jewish rabbi, the late Joshua Liebman, wrote a book some years ago entitled Peace of Mind. And he has a chapter in that book entitled Love Thyself Properly. And what he says in that chapter in substance is that before you can love other selves adequately, you've got to love your own self properly. You know, a lot of people don't love themselves. They go through life with deep and haunting emotional conflict. So the length of life means that you must love yourself. And you know what loving yourself also means? It means that you've got to accept yourself. So many people are busy trying to be somebody else. God gave all of us something and something significant, and we must pray every day asking God to help us to accept ourselves. That means everything. To too many Negroes are ashamed of themselves, ashamed of being black. Negro got to rise up and say from the bottom of his soul, I am somebody. I have a rich, noble, and proud heritage. However exploited and however painful my history has been, I'm black, but I'm black and beautiful. This is what we got to say. We've got to accept ourselves. We must pray, Lord, help me to accept myself every day. Help me to accept my truth. I remember when I was in college, I majored in sociology, and all sociology majors had to take a course that was required called statistics. Statistics can be very complicated. You've got to have a mathematical mind, a real knowledge of geometry, and you've got to know how to find the mean, the mode, and the median. I never will forget, I took this course, and I had a fellow classmate who could just work that stuff out, you know, and he could do his homework in about an hour. We would often go to the lab or the workshop, and he would just work it out in about an hour, and it was over for him. I was trying to do what he was doing. I was trying to do mine in an hour. And the more I tried to do it in an hour, the more I was clunking out in the course. And I had to come to a very hard conclusion. I had to sit down and say, now, Martin Luther King, at least Cain has a better mind than you. Sometimes you have to acknowledge that. And I had to say to myself, now, he may be able to do it in an hour. It takes me 2 or 3 hours to do it. I was not willing to accept myself. I was not willing to accept my tools and my limitations. You know, in life, we are called upon to do that. A Ford car trying to be a Cadillac is absurd, but if a Ford would accept itself as a Ford, it can do many things that a Cadillac could never do. It can get in parking spaces that a Cadillac can never get in. In life, some of us are Fords and some of us are Cadillacs. Moses says in green pastures, Lord, I ain't much, but I's all I got. The principle of self-acceptance is a basic principle in life. Now, the other thing about the length of life, us accepting ourselves and our tools, we must discover what we are called to do. And once we discover it, we should set out to do it. All of the strength and all of the power that we have in our system. After we've discovered what God called us to do, after we've discovered our life's work, we should set out to do that work so well that the living, the dead, or the unborn couldn't do it any better. Now, this does not mean that everybody will do the so-called big recognized things of life. Very few people will rise to the heights of genius and the arts of the science. Very few collectively will rise to certain professions. Most of us will have to be content to work in the fields and in the factories and in on the streets, but we must see the dignity of all labor. I was in Montgomery, Alabama. I went to a shoe shop quite often, known as the Golf. There was a fella in there that used to shine my shoes, and it was just an experience to witness this fella shining my shoes. Get that rag, you know. And he could bring music out of it. I said to myself, this fella has a PhD in shoe shining. What I'm saying to you this morning, my friend, even if it falls your lot to be a street sweeper, go out in sweet streets like Michelangelo painted these pictures. Sweet streets like Handel and Beethoven composed music. Sweet streets like Shakespeare wrote poetry. Sweet streets like the hosts of heaven and earth will have to pause and say, here lived a great street sweeper who swept his job well. If you can't be a pine on the top of a hill, be a scrub in the valley, but be the best little scrub on the side of the rill. Be a bush if you can't be a tree. If you can't be a highway, just be a trail. If you can't be the sun, be a star. It isn't by size that you win or you fail. Be the best of whatever you are. And when you do this, you've mastered the length of life. This onward push to the end of self-fulfillment is the end of a person's life. Now, don't stop here, though. So a lot of people get no further in life than the length. They develop their inner powers. They do their jobs well. You know, they try to live as if nobody else lives in the world but themselves. And they use everybody as mere tools to get to where they're going. Yes. They don't love anybody but themselves. And the only kind of love that they really have for other people is utilitarian love. You know, they just love people that they can use. A lot of people never get beyond the first dimension of life. They use other people as mere steps by which they can climb their goals and their ambitions. These people don't work out well in life. They may go for a while. They may think they're making it all right. But there is the law. They call it the law of gravitation in the physical universe. And it works. It's final. It's inexorable. Whatever goes up can come down. You shall reap what you sow. God has structured this universe that way. And he who goes through life not concerned about others will be a subject victim of this law. So I move on and say that it is necessary to add breath to length. Now, the breath of life is the outward concern for the welfare of others, as I said. Man has not begun to live until he can rise.